Well, good to see you again. I think the last time you came in to speak to us was when you had your son with you.
Charlie Malarkey.
That's right.
Yeah.
That was fun. And how has he recovered from the excitement of all that?
Well, he's decided he wants to be a writer, believe it or not. And he just wrote his first short story by himself for class and got double A-minus on it, which A for effort and A for technique. And so he's very happy.
I was talking to Jack Hemingway a while ago, one of Ernest Hemingway's son, and he was saying that when he was in school, his teacher was flunking him every time he turned in a story or an essay, and Hemingway said, "But I know that my piece of writing was just as good as John's right next to me," but the teacher said, "But you're a Hemingway, we expect more from you."
Yeah.
So that's a dangerous undertaking to follow in the footsteps of the old man, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I never encouraged it, but that's what he's decided to do. I mean, he could do a lot of things. He could go into nonfiction. He might go into the movies. I have no idea what he's going to do.
No, he's pretty young yet. The whole future.
He's just starting to go to college now. He just finished, and he'll be 18 in July. Just finished. I got to give his commencement address Friday afternoon. And he's off to Trinity over in Hartford.
Mm.
So he's going to have a good time.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Quinn's book. I noticed I was reading the first page, and I think you have probably written the longest one sentence I've ever seen in a book. Why did you make that so long?
There was a time when I was going to write the whole book as one sentence. I decided that was a little artificial, but that first sentence struck me as a significant way of getting into the language, the set of events, very rapidly compacting so many things in there, and you know, just entering the 19th century in a way that would be unusual. And I think that it sets the tone for Quinn, looking back at himself, and certainly he discovers Maud, the love of his life, at this moment, and so it's his singular recollection.
Parenthetically, William Packard, who edits a quarterly review of poetry, I can't remember the name of the magazine, but he did write a book as one sentence. All of the the thoughts were connected with the word "and," so it never stopped. I'm not sure it actually worked. I mean, it was a self-conscious effort to do something different. I'm not sure I would have done it, and I'm glad you didn't do it. Well, tell me how Quinn's book fits into the framework of your Albany cycle.
Well, this Quinn, who's the narrator here, is the grandfather of Daniel Quinn, the 10-year-old boy in Ironweed. And also, he appears in Billy Phelan's Greatest Game, has an even larger role. But he's that family is moving forward. The Dohertys are in there, out of Billy Phelan. Emmett Dohertey is an ancestor of Martin Dohertey. The McCalls are introduced historically for the second time, McCalls being an equivalent of the political forces who lead Albany and into the 20th century. And one of their ancestors appears in this book. There's any number of connections forward and backward, and it was it's a precursor of our era that I feel I'm living through, and it tends to reflect elements of some of the things I've written about in the other books, and a lot more: the politics, the racial question, the theater, and journalism, and a whole lot more.
It must be a strange feeling to have written your earlier Albany books in a time sequence closer to this period And yet Quinn's book, of course, is the beginning of everything. It's kind of strange to write out of sequence like that, isn't it?
Well, it's what becomes possible. I never thought of anything being done in any chronological way, and it's more exciting, frankly, to not think of it that way, and to look for new people who will be able to say something that you haven't said before in the other books. The tendency to in continuing the same line of same family and so on is that you might find yourself stringing it out too thin, you know, attenuating the material. I suppose that can happen, but Quinn just seemed to me be a very rich character, and these other people who populate his world are comparably exciting for me to play with. The whole sense of that bare knuckle fighting, and that the kind of a guy that John Nebron is, and Magdalena, what she represented in the 19th century independent woman, and of course the whole Stats line, the Stats family, the old Dutch family, which is really the initial heritage that we have in the city, and which this country has in large measure in the Northeast, especially in New York City. So it's what your imagination tells you you have to do, and this one was a particularly happy event.
Happy. Well, you mentioned, you used the term happy, but of course Quinn's book gets off with a major disaster, a big ice flow that disrupts the city of Albany, causes a big fire, a bridge collapses, a barge overturns, all these people die. From a historical standpoint, how accurate is this?
Well, it's quite accurate. There were any number of bridge collapses. There were these floods and the overflowings of the river. The river overflows its banks, and the water goes into a lime kiln and starts a fire. It slacks the lime, and a kind of chemical combustion takes place, and the pier burns down. This happens. This happened in Albany, and
did it happen at the date that you said it?
It doesn't happen at the particular date. I've intensified these events, but the city did burn about a twelfth of it or so burned down one time, as it does in here, a year or so earlier than it happened in my book. I put it in 1949, but it was a significant event for the city. You know, a great disaster, and the river, of course, being this. You know, incredible problem. There was no bridge across the river at that time, and you had to go over by boat. And this whole event where the people are on the bridge to watch Magdalena Colon cross as a publicity stunt, this really was based, in fact, based on a very famous woman performer by the name of Lola Montez out of the 19th century. And she came to Albany and did precisely this, not in the same year either. But it did happen that way, and the boat capsized, and there was a near tragedy. I didn't...
Of course, if anybody knows the historical facts about the Albany area, I guess it's you, huh? I mean, a lot of the material, I guess, was in Old Albany, a book you wrote a couple of years ago.
Some of this is reflected back then, that's true. Almost all of the book is based on, you know, strong reality of that era. The draft riots in New York City, the hard to believe what happened in those days, and in those 5 days of those riots in 1863. One of the most, probably the most violent urban eruption in the history of the country. And I only scratched the surface of it here. It takes place... specifically because of a plot development in one character's life. The ethnic riots, the Irish being involved against the nativists, the established order here of working classes who resented the heavy influx of Irish immigrants who were inimical to their lives, took their jobs and so on, worked more cheaply, and the antipathy between the blacks and the Irish at that time, because especially during those Civil War riots, the draft riots, when anybody with $300 could buy their way out of the draft, but the poor man could not, and the poorest of the poor were the Irish, and they were the most numerous and most likely to become cannon fodder in a draft, and so they resisted it very strongly.
So much violence, so much death.
That's right. It's the way that world was, you know, in the 19th century.
Picture it. I mean, we know there's violence today, that people are going around the borough of Queens with machine guns, shooting up houses and throwing firebombs like something out of the 20s and 30s in Chicago. But somehow we look at our American past. I guess there were episodes of violence, and yet maybe I have just put them out of my mind.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons that this book was so interesting to write for me, because it was the discovery of just how much we don't remember about the 19th century, unless you really go back and make it a point to study the everyday coverage of what was happening. The violence was extraordinary, and there's a piece in here, a set piece near the end of the book called about the hills and the creeks, the Ryans and the Palmers, where this working man's riot erupts. This was a commonplace thing. It used to happen every Sunday. People who hated one another would go out and just fight in mob scenes. It happened in the streets of New York. 1,000 people fighting down here. The gangs were roaming the streets and with far more impunity than they are today.
But all these people seem to be related.
Well,
look, another life. The Hatfields and the McCoys, I guess.
Not entirely related, but it was a tissue of heavy violence in that century. And we tend to gloss over it and think of the good old days.
Now, in An Ironweed, you seem to show a certain interest or fascination in death, and this seems to be the case with Quinn's book. In fact, Magdalena, is that her name?
Magdalena Colon.
Where she almost magically, through a sexual act, comes back to life. Do you really have a preoccupation with death, or is this something that is necessary in the writing of your fiction?
Well, it's an element of life, isn't it, for everybody? And it's a galvanizing element. It's the resurrection of Magdalena was an invention, obviously. But not long after.
Can you explain how that happened?
Yeah, right. I can tell you exactly how it happened. I wrote the first chapter in which she capsizes in our boat. The boat capsizes and she's drowned, and her corpse is saved, and then she's brought back to life by the sunny friction of joy, as Quinn puts it. And the death of Magdalena seemed to me to be a waste. She was so interesting after the first chapter to me, I decided that she should be resurrected. About 2 years, 3 years after I wrote that scene, which I wrote down about 1982, there was this case of this child who drowned in a frigid river and was at the bottom of the water for 45 minutes. And they brought him up and brought him back to life. His whole life system was just so. This is not more than a year ago, I think, that this happened, and so you know, it's not as outlandish as it seems.
No. You've been working on Quinn's book for quite a while.
I've been working on this version that has been published for about 5 years, and with some interruptions for university business or working on the Ironweed film and Cotton Club, the film. Those were interruptions. But I had started a book like this about 1977, and wasn't able to make it work to my own satisfaction, and I abandoned that and wrote Ironweed in the meantime, and then wrote O Albany, and then went back to this, and the second time around it began to take shape, and the focus in the original one was the 20th century with Daniel Quinn, the boy from Ironweed who grows up, and the book was going to be set somewhere in the 50s, or maybe the 60s, and that just didn't work for me. So I had begun a 19th century portion of that book, sort of a looking back into another time by Quinn, and seeing an alter ego, and that alter ego took over the book. It just became far more interesting in terms of language, in terms of distancing from my own contemporary moment, that made it work for me. It's hard to understand why that happened, but I guess all my books, in a sense, are historical novels, and they don't seem to be. You don't think of Legg's gangster book as a historical novel, but it is, and it took a great deal of historical research to establish the age and establish the gangster and as this true figure who took over the imagination of many, many people in this country.
Are you going to continue the Albany cycle, or are you going to branch out into something entirely different?
No, I think that it's the Albany cycle is sufficient for me. I don't know what the next book will be exactly, but it'll be different from all the others. And it'll probably be different in style. And I might write another book about someplace else someday, but I don't have any plans for it. And nothing seems to appeal to me any more than Albany does. I don't have to go anywhere else. It's just the nature of the place and my knowledge of it, my attachment to it, that I can probably stay there forever.
Tell me about Ironweed, the movie. You wrote the screenplay for that. That must have been pretty exciting. All of Albany must have turned out for that.
Yeah, we had 6 months worth of circus up there. It was terrific. It really was. I liked the movie very much. It was a, and I loved working on it. I thought the Hector Babenco, the director, really did a very fine job, as far as I'm concerned. He was very faithful to the novel, as faithful as you can be in the film. And we had those incredible performers, Jack Nicholson and Meryl Streep and Tom Waits, Carol Baker. They were spectacular people to work with, and I don't think we got better performances all year.
Would you have felt comfortable having someone else working on the screenplay?
No, I wouldn't have. That's why I was very close to the vest with that. I wanted to do my own self-amputative surgery, as I put it, someplace. But turning it over to somebody to just turn it into a work of somebody else's imagination didn't appeal to me at all.
That is a danger with movies, isn't it? The director and other people who do the scripts can really make changes and change the thrust of what the story is supposed to be.
That's correct. It can.
Lose all control.
Right. But in this case, we went in with a certain amount of control, and everybody respected that. So I was there throughout the... Whenever anything had to be changed, I changed it. Some changes along the way, and some expansions of the story. Went back to the book and took things out that hadn't been in the original script. And but it was very harmonious working with Hector.
Are you working on something now? Are you in the process now of soaking up the results of Quinn's book?
Well, I've been mostly just touring for Quinn, and also having a a look at the material for the next book. I've been working toward that for about a year. Before I finished Quinn, I was working on something, you know, making notes toward a new book. And it's now, well, about 3 days ago I wrote the first page. So I may be off, I may not. I may be off and running, I mean.
Nobody's been able to explain how the creative process works. And you start with a line, start with a paragraph or with a thought, and somehow it usually results in something, but I don't think anybody can explain just how or why.
Well, you just make choices after a time. You gestate, and in the imagination, in the subconscious mind, all your notes, all your preferences, all your special characters. You want to go forward in some way, and you just can't make the move. And then all of a sudden, you wake up one morning, and it's possible. You've made a decision somewhere, and you arrive at some place that's really comfortable for you, that you can manage, that you understand, that you feel has that scope and that significance that you started out to find. But it's hard to get to, and sometimes you can't get to it, and sometimes you fall starts.
Yeah, it must take a lot of self-determination to be able to sit down there by yourself without anybody prompting you and turning out a work of fiction. But most people can't do it. They need to go to an office, punch a time clock, work with other people, and take orders and direction. But as a fiction writer has to work independently.
You have to work alone, and I find it a great pleasure to work alone. Some people hate it. Some writers can only stand it for so long. I can somehow go on for 6-8 hours. Sometimes more if the juices are up, you know, if you're working well, or if you're just in some kind of solitude and reading and ruminating. It's very comfortable. It's very I haven't done it enough lately, and that's what I'm looking forward to getting back to in another few weeks. And you know, it's probably the best thing that I do, you know, in terms of satisfaction.
It beats writing sports for a newspaper, I'll bet.
Well, eating lobster is an equivalent.
Oh, there's
a close second.
A close second to to what?
Writing books.
Well, I don't. Yeah. Well, I don't know. A couple of years ago, I went up to Maine. I thought the whole week I'm up here, I'm going to eat lobster every day. By the end of 3 days, lobster didn't start to look good to me anymore. In fact, I don't think I touched another lobster for about 2 years. It was coming out of my socks. Well, another winner from William Kennedy, Quinn's book, highly recommended. Thank you very, very much.
Okay.